spoke about gratitude. We looked at it as a spiritual practice. You could just kick the doorstop down. We spoke about it as a spiritual practice, one of the spiritual tools of our heritage. We've been talking about yoga poses of the soul, the postures that we take that bring about health and well-being. This is one of those. Well, during the week, I got an email from Kate Kish and from Tammy. Tammy replied to it. I copied and pasted. I asked them for permission. I copied and pasted it. It's on our Facebook group. You can read the whole thing. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it said. Kate said, you know, during the what are you thinking part of the lesson last week, I realized that I have taken way too passive an attitude toward my own interior emotional states. I've been following an approach that is called, she called it the wait till I feel better approach. She said, it hadn't occurred to me that I am in control of my interior states, and the gratitude is one of the ways that I take control of my interior states. So she said, how did I miss that? She said, if I'm tired, I know to take a nap. If I'm hungry, I know to eat, and I don't wait until I feel less tired. I don't wait until I am less hungry. I don't depend on someone else to make me feel less tired or less hungry. But with the interior state, I have taken this very passive attitude. But when, she said, I heard what Tammy said in the what are you thinking part about gratitude being a way that we work this muscle of our minds, it was something that I kind of knew, she said, but I hadn't really taken hold of in my life. So last week, she said, I took hold of it. She said, Tammy reminded me that these practices of the soul are just that. They are practices, practices that we practice. So good for Kate, good for Tammy. There's an old saying about thankfulness that it is not happiness that makes us grateful, it is gratitude that makes us happy. That's why bringing intentionality to our gratitude works this muscle that changes our thinking. Actually, what it does is it strengthens the connections between certain axons and dendrites in our head so that the electrical charges can travel that path just as easily as they can travel the negative posture, the negative framing posture path. And so, when we work this muscle, we actually change our brains. We change our thinking. Change our thinking, it turns out, and we end up changing our actions. Big actions flow from our thinking. So here's a chain of events. Change your thinking, change your actions. Change your actions, and over time, you begin to change your habits because that's what happens to our brains. You do something repeatedly, and it becomes cached, it becomes habitual. Change your actions, change your habits. Change your habits, change your lifestyle. And eventually change your lifestyle, you begin to change your destiny. You begin to change the world that we all participate in creating every day. And so because of that, the ancient spiritual tradition has insisted that we don't wait for circumstances to align in some kind of a perfect way for us to be grateful. What we actually do is move toward that posture. We take that posture of gratitude on with purpose. Sometimes things do align, and sometimes we are overrun with spontaneity in terms of our gratitude, but that's rare. It's not really the norm. The norm is that we tend to, because the way our amygdala is wired, we tend to go toward the negative. That would be more the norm. But if we take up the spiritual tradition's offer, we bring intentionality to the process. Well, that whole experience of reading that email reminded me of a story that I read some time ago. I'm going to read it to you now. It's from a book. It's called Thank You, Power. David was having a tough day. He was new to New York City. He'd already been worn down. He wasn't any longer excited or proud about living in Manhattan. He came to town thinking he was talented and he'd take the world by storm. But now he was a low-level assistant, unable to afford his own place, and uncomfortable sponging off a friend. He said, I was rethinking my abilities as a writer, my career choice, and on that Saturday, all I wanted to do was stay in bed. But no, I had to go drop off a photo for work, and it was a cold, gray, and damp day, and I headed across town. He said, I don't know why I did it, but I decided that I would start counting things that made me happy. First on my list, right out the door, was a mother walking her baby, all bundled up in a stroller, and that little face just made me smile. I saw a jet, and that reminded me how captivating I find flying. There were the sizzling smells at bistros. There were eye-catching store windows. One thing after another brightened my mood, and by the time I picked up the photo, again, I was very thankful that I had moved to New York. I remembered what an exciting, interesting, invigorating place it is. And now, this many years later, whenever I'm feeling down, I do a gratitude walk. And it always makes me feel better. That's a real thing, because gratitude awakens within us hope that is there. And hope strengthens us for life, and hope strengthens us for the mission that was given us by Jesus, to bring light to wherever there are shadows, to bring healing wherever there are wounds, to give our gifts to others, our gift of wisdom or goodness, compassion or laughter, camaraderie and love. And so we are encouraged by those who have gone before us on this spiritual path to bring intentionality to our practice of gratitude. Because it's very easy to forget about that ancient wisdom, especially when life is going on. It's easy to forget when we get caught up in current affairs or the injustices and indignities of daily life, the petty troubles that come with our jobs and with our homes. So we can help one another. That's part of being a part of spiritual community, so that as we are on this journey together, we can remind one another when we fall into the disheartening times, we encourage one another to bring intentionality to our gratitude. So that was last week's lesson on gratitude, and I pray that you make that part of your spiritual practice. This week, I'd like to talk about another of the ancient rhythms that's so easily forgotten, but that is also transformative, another posture that brings health to our souls. It comes from the words of Jesus, but we know it as the golden rule. Here's a simple rule of thumb. Ask yourself how you would like people to treat you, and then be the first to go. Do that thing for them. That simple idea captures all the wisdom of the law and the prophets. I meet people over at Person Street Pharmacy Cafe all the time, folks from the church, folks that I'm getting to know. It's very close by, and they've got great coffee, so I meet there. And in their bathroom, they've got two paintings from this well-known artist, Norman Rockwell. Norman Rockwell was very well-known during his lifetime. He was well-known, but he wasn't taken very seriously. He did the covers for Saturday Evening Post, which was a magazine, and he did that for almost 50 years, and that was before the media saturation that we have today, so people knew about the Saturday Evening Post, and consequently people knew about Norman Rockwell. The reason that art critics and culture critics did not take him very seriously was that they said that his work was too sweet or too sentimental or too idealistic. But in a sense, Rockwell painted a commonly held American mindset during his life. The years after World War II were very optimistic years in our nation. The Great Depression was behind us. There was a boom economy. We had fought a series of wars that we thought had finally brought an end to global conflict. More and more people were moving into the middle class. There was broader and broader access to prosperity, more than there had ever been before. And it seemed to many that the hard times had passed, that we were on solid ground, and it was going to be okay. So in a sense, Norman Rockwell was painting the backdrop for this very optimistic moment in American history. And then the Cold War began to grind forward. And the reality that there were a gazillion nuclear warheads pointed all across the planet began to settle in. And there were several ongoing conflicts in Eastern Europe. And Vietnam was dragging on and on. And it began to dawn on us that war, conflict, might be a perpetual state. And conflict wasn't limited to just having conflict with other nations. There was also a rising conflict with one another. Racial inequity that had been normalized for so long and had been avoided for so long would no longer stay swept under the carpet, and it began to come out in the form of conflict. Gender inequity, same thing. It would no longer stay normalized, and it would no longer stay suppressed. So in general terms, the post-war optimism was giving way to high degrees of conflict, and that conflict was coming with its own state of weariness and discouragement, fatigue and hopelessness. There was despair in the air, anger and blame, not unlike the shared emotional state that many feel in our own time. And a retrospective of Norman Rockwell's work has noted that in this time he began rethinking his posture and began rethinking his painting. And in his lifetime, he wasn't taken seriously, but now in hindsight, many people are beginning to do that. Because he began to paint these challenging times as well. He began to address racial inequity. He began to address racial violence. And he began to address racial injustice. As the nation was grappling with these tough issues, he began to treat these challenging themes in his paintings. And when he did so, he brought the same hope that he had brought to his more nostalgic paintings. He brought his same appreciation of the beauty of the human spirit to the challenges of making right what had long been so wrong. He began to paint hope and aspiration for a nation. Hope that we could do better than war. Hope that we could do better than violence. Hope that we could do better than inequity. And that too, interestingly, began to capture our national sense of hope. Well, during that time, as he was grappling with his own interior framing to bring to his painting, he embarked on a rather lengthy reading project, and he began to read broadly the sacred texts of all the world's religions. He read Christian texts and Jewish texts and Buddhist texts and Hindu texts. He did a comparative study of the world's great religious traditions. And as he did, he hit upon a recurring theme, which happens almost any time someone takes a comparative study of all the great religions. He hit upon this recurring theme, and as was his way, he put that theme into his painting as well. It became a famous painting. He noted that every major religious tradition, though the wording might be different, every major religious tradition holds in reverence the golden rule. The rule captures universal human wisdom. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In the faces of the planet, Rockwell captured the ordinariness of the human condition. He captured farmers and office workers and students and scholars and women and men and fathers and mothers and children. And onto that study of the human condition, he overlaid the divine wisdom. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It turns out there really isn't any other way to answer the conflicts that divide us. It is an ancient wisdom, and it is a human wisdom. And yes, it is a difficult wisdom, but again, there isn't really any other answer. All of the institutions of state and all of the strategies of power are for naught unless they become vehicles of this ancient wisdom. the wisdom that is in every one of us because the Spirit of God is within every one of us. That is the way forward through times of despair and discouragement. It is the way forward through nuclear threat. It is the way forward through racial inequity. It is the way forward through gender discrimination. It is the way forward between in the way of access to educational opportunity and economic disparity, and there really is no other viable strategy. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, in our community, in these lessons, we've noted on several occasions that few among us have sway over national or international or even local city events. But again, this wisdom is the way forward. So, in our role as citizens, it is our responsibility to remind our representatives of this wisdom. It is to us to practice this wisdom in our own days. It is to us to champion this wisdom in our spheres of influence, in our own city. Jared's working really hard to break things down into things that we can do together that are here now, small, doable, as we've been talking about. It is to us to apply this wisdom to our children's schools and to teach them to be practicing it in their classrooms. It is to us to practice this wisdom when we go to work. Do unto others what you would have them do unto you. It's a simple rule of thumb that captures divine wisdom that has echoed through the centuries. It is a deep truth, and it is an answer to what ails us, and it is the clear distillation of religion, of our religion, and of everybody else's religion too. Do unto others what you would have them do unto you. And do it when it's easy. And do it when it's not easy. And do it when it's in your personal best interests. And do it when it's not in your personal best interests. Do it when your in-group approves of you doing it. And do it when your in-group scorns you for doing it. I was scrolling through the channels a while ago, and I came upon a scene from a movie I've seen before. There's a good chance you've seen it, too. The movie is Radio. It's a movie about a southern South Carolina town where I understand people take high school football very seriously. And a football coach had kind of taken under his wing a developmentally challenged kid and invited him to the team practices, drove him home afterwards, got him into classes, invited him out of isolation into a state of belonging. And the thing is that even though that's as a noble thing to do, the community disapproved of it in the strongest terms, and they made it quite difficult on the coach because he kept on doing it. And I just turned on the scene where he was explaining why he'd done it, and his justification was very simple. He said, I figure it's the right thing to do. In the face of resistance from players and ridicule from the booster club, all the racial undertones of his decision, the stigma of disability, all the social resistance, all the cultural resistance, well, I figured it was the right thing to do. If I was disabled, and if I was wandering the streets alone, and if I was isolated from community, and if I was afraid, if my world was a shrunken version of what it could be, that's what I would want someone to do for me. And that's what makes it the right thing to do. It's an instinct that is deep inside of us as human beings. It's in you, it's in me, because it's part of that deepest indwelling reality. We cast around for words to try and talk about that deep part of us. We call it the indwelling Spirit of God, or we call it the indwelling divine, whatever we call it. The right thing to do, it is in us, because the Spirit of God is in us. Intentionally going out of our way in order to find hurt that we might not have seen, for the very purpose of bringing love to that hurt, that's in us. The right thing to do is in us. So what I thought we would do this morning is take a moment to reflect. Hopefully you've had a restful holiday week. You've had some time to decompress from the dailiness of life. So if you would, find a comfortable place in your body. Take a few breaths. Oftentimes, things that have not been processed, we carry in our bodies. So look for tension in your body and allow that tension to go. Some of the common places we hold that tension are around our jaw. Take note of the area around your eyes, maybe your neck, across your shoulders. Take a deep breath in. Relax more deeply as you exhale. A deep breath in. Relax more deeply as you exhale. Now in this quiet place, allow to bubble up a place or a person, a time, a situation. Listen for a whisper or a nudge where you could live out that deep reality. Here's a way in your days at the places you go. As you are doing the things that you do, here's a way to live that deep reality. You could treat someone else this way. You could take the initiative in that place. You could go first there. And if an inner nudge bubbles up, go ahead and jot yourself a reminder, maybe on your phone, in the paper, in the seat back. Go ahead, take a moment. Holy Spirit, may we be carriers of the indwelling divine, carrying that to the world around us as we look in the days before us for opportunities to practice this ancient wisdom, to practice this golden rule as we follow Jesus. Amen. Now, it's not really the point of this lesson, but Rockwell expanded that painting of the Golden Rule and made a mural as a gift to the United Nations. It was an invitation to the representatives of our planet to orient themselves around this wisdom. Now, that would be an easy target for cynicism as you think about the way things go in our world, except that the story's not done. We don't know how this story ends. And it might be that that wisdom, which is our only viable way forward, will in the end have its day. Well, if you would, please prepare your tithes and offerings. And as you're doing that, you can go to our website right there on your phone, go to the